their lives already hang by a thread. So if we don't get to them, they will pay the ultimate price.
Preventing a massive famine. It's Wednesday, April 22nd, and this is VOA Asia. Coming to you from Washington, I'm Doug Bernard. Also ahead, COVID-19 claims its first major corporation, and Hong Kong protesters under growing threat from China. That and more, all on today's VOA Asia. The airline Virgin Australia has become the first big corporate casualty of the COVID-19 pandemic. Australia's second largest carrier placed itself into the hands of voluntary administrators on Tuesday after the federal government refused to bail out the troubled business. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Virgin Australia grounded almost all its flights when the government in Canberra closed the nation's international borders because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Foreign travellers are banned from entering and Australians prohibited from leaving. The impact of the coronavirus emergency on Australia's second largest airline has been calamitous. A senior executive said it was a crisis completely outside of the company's control. It was already struggling with more than $3 billion of debt and is now in the hands of independent administrators. They'll try to find new buyers and investors after failing to secure a loan from the government. Ministers insisted that if Virgin Australia was bailed out, it would encourage other under-siege businesses to lobby for support. About 15,000 airline jobs are at risk, but the opposition Labour leader Anthony Albanese says the impact of Virgin Australia's collapse will be felt far more broadly.
It's about not just the 15,000 people who depend directly on Virgin Australia for their jobs. It's about the hundreds of thousands of Australians who depend upon tourism for their jobs. It's about the millions of Australians who depend upon a two-airline system in order to be able to afford to get around this country.
Consumer groups are concerned that unless Virgin Australia can be saved, Qantas, the nation's biggest carrier, will have a near monopoly in a vast country where air travel is essential. Higher airfares for passengers would be a likely consequence. Virgin Australia has been in talks with state governments in New South Wales and Queensland, but has yet to secure financial support. The airline is part-owned by various groups, including the government of the United Arab Emirates, Chinese enterprises, and Singapore Airlines. Its decline is a symptom of the crisis within global aviation. Voluntary administration is a process where an insolvent company, which is unable to pay its debts, is placed in the hands of financial experts who can investigate how the business might be saved or sold and creditors paid back. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
These are among the Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Driver killed in WHO vehicle carrying virus swabs in Myanmar's Rakhine State. Singapore extends lockdown amid surge in COVID cases. Japan and the IOC at odds over who will pay for the Tokyo Olympics postponement. And less testing could account for poorer nations' lower virus cases. Those stories and much more all at our website, voanews.com. Listening to VOA Asia. A new UN report warns that more than one quarter of a billion people could face acute hunger because of the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the 2020 reports on the food crisis.
Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, the report said 135 million people around the world were suffering from severe hunger. But authors of the report warn the pandemic will more than double that number by the end of the year if swift, vigorous action is not taken. The report cites the main drivers of world hunger as conflict, climate change, and economic crises. It says Africa is the worst affected continent in the world, followed by Asia and Latin America. It adds the majority of people suffering acute food insecurity, some 77%, are in countries of conflict. World Food Program Chief Economist Arif Hussein tells VOA people in countries such as Yemen, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Afghanistan, Syria, and South Sudan run the greatest risks.
If we don't get to them, their lives already hang by a thread. So if we don't get to them, they will pay the ultimate price. Every given day, in normal times, there are about 21,000 people who lose their lives to hunger. Every given day, not COVID, every given day. A child dies every 10 seconds because of malnutrition.
Hussein says quick action must be taken to assist people and those in other countries at risk. He says trade and supply chains must act, and food and other necessary supplies must be prepositioned. He says aid agencies can and must help governments that have safety nets and protection plans scale up those programs.
We should not forget about the agricultural sector. Imagine, okay, fine, we have good stocks right now, but if the supply chain stops to work, and seeds and fertilizer and other things are not getting to the farmers, or farmers cannot go to the field, what will happen next year? Next year, we will actually have a shortage of food. And that is something we must avoid.
UN aid agencies anticipate they will need between $10 and $12 billion this year to tackle the expected food crisis. But they say they need $1.9 billion immediately to make sure enough food is in place to assist people over the next 3 months, especially those who are trapped in war zones. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This Asia News update from VOA. Southeast Asian nations are joining a growing list of countries around the world rushing to release prisoners from overcrowded jails in hopes of warding off new outbreaks of COVID-19, although some are still hesitating. For more, you can visit us at our website, voanews.com. Hong Kong police arrested 14 prominent democracy activists on Saturday in the biggest crackdown on the pro-democracy movement since the mass anti-government protests began to rock the southern Chinese city last June. Dean Cheng is a senior research fellow for Chinese political and security affairs at the Heritage Foundation. VOA's Steve Miller asked him for his take on the arrests, why he thought they had occurred now.
I've been wondering sort of what the Chinese have been thinking about Hong Kong in the midst of COVID-19. My impression is that the protests have died down, not surprising given that nobody wants to spread it. But given this lull, would Beijing make the best of it and do very little to try and keep things tamped down, or would they instead take advantage of this as an opportunity? And clearly they've decided to go with the latter.
Now, if we take a look at what at least the Hong Kong government is putting out about the arrest, they were essentially these individuals being arrested for illegal assembly. And during last year, during the time of the pro-democracy protests, a lot of the assemblies and protests were in fact not given permission to do so. So if you take a look at what the Hong Kong government is saying is their rationale for arresting these individuals, what do you take in terms of that information as opposed to Beijing's statements earlier and later last year opposing the pro-democracy movement?
So when we look at how the Chinese write about legal warfare, it is the use of the law writ broadly. So laws, regulations, treaties, international law, domestic law, in order to achieve previously determined political ends. And they've emphasized it isn't really a matter of legality as we understand it. Go to a impartial court and adjudicate things. It is the use of legal instruments to achieve what you wanted to achieve anyway. It's to basically, as they themselves say, what we do is right, what you do is wrong, and if what we do has to be wrong, it's because you've created a situation like that. Is arresting these activists the right answer? Is this typical or in other cases of quote-unquote illegal assembly? Do people get summonses? Do they get fines, et cetera? And that's before we look at this in the context of Chinese statements just this past week, for example, where the liaison office and the Office for Hong Kong and Macau Affairs said, we report directly to Beijing and our authority trumps anything in Hong Kong.
Now, if we take a look at, you know, Hong Kong in general, you know, in 2047, you know, the provisions under the Basic Law go away. And some people are saying that the latest arrests are further evidence that Beijing is trying to upend the one country, two systems program that's in place. What does it mean for those who are advocating for either greater autonomy or a greater democracy in Hong Kong moving forward?
I think Beijing is sending a very clear message to the citizens of Hong Kong at all levels. You will be assimilated and resistance is futile.
So what does that do in terms of protections for Hong Kong with the international community? I mean, this is definitely an issue internal to China, but as China continues, mainland China, Beijing continues to, as you put it, assimilate Hong Kong. Is there anything that the outside community can do to kind of safeguard the protections in the Basic Law?
Well, the Basic Law, if I recall correctly, was also a treaty between the UK and China that set the conditions for the handover. And very clearly, Beijing is violating the terms of that treaty. So the first and foremost foreign government that would have a say, arguably, is Her Majesty's government in London. We have also seen, for example, the Swedes take a stand in the case of one of the booksellers who was a Swedish-Chinese citizen. The Chinese, however, have also made very clear their reaction to that when they arrested, literally detained and arrested this bookseller from a train compartment in front of two Swedish diplomats. So Beijing has made very clear it doesn't really care what outsiders may think. Now, that may change, especially with COVID-19. One, because China's behavior in the international sphere is clearly being put under closer scrutiny and has greater impact. And second of all, because China does want to do things like build out the global 5G network. I think that this week's announcement by the British government, for example, that they are reexamining allowing Huawei into their networks may be a function not so much of the specifics of Hong Kong, but a growing sense that China is simply not playing by international rules.
That was Senior Research Fellow for Chinese Political and Security Affairs at the Heritage Foundation, Dean Chang, speaking with VOA's Steve Miller.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This Asia News Update from VOA. As Ramadan begins with the new moon later this week, Muslims around the world are trying to maintain the cherished rituals of Islam's holiest month without further spreading the outbreak. For more on this story and much more, you can visit us at voanews.com.
This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Jakarta's Pertaminajaya Hospital is readying Amy, a human-sized robot made in China, and screen-faced droid Temi as it takes in virus patients. Amy holds a food and drinks tray that will help hospital workers avoid direct contact with patients who will be able to communicate with doctors via video call on U.S.-made Temi screen. Around the world, robots are increasingly being used in the fight against the coronavirus as they are seen as fast, efficient, and contagion-proof. But Indonesia's robotic pair will not replace all contact, including critical treatment of sick patients.
Both robots, or artificial intelligence that we're going to use, will only function as assistants, not substitutions, for our medical team. So we do not see the necessity of employing them more than that. We're currently in the middle of testing to figure out which functions can be assisted by them.
In neighboring city-state Singapore, researchers have invented a disinfecting robot with an arm that mimics human movement to help take the load off overworked cleaners during the pandemic. Meanwhile, Malaysian scientists created a barrel-shaped robot on wheels they hope will make the rounds on hospital wards, while robots in Denmark are using ultraviolet light to disinfect frequently touched surfaces. At the time of this report, Indonesia has 7,135 confirmed cases of the coronavirus. At Baishizhou, a large food market in the Chinese city of Wuhan, signs forbid the selling of wild animals and live fowl, while announcements calling for victory over COVID-19 play on a loop from speakers. China's wet markets have been slammed internationally as the coronavirus roils the world, with the disease having seemingly emerged from stalls selling live game in Wuhan late last year.
When it came out, I was worried about my mother going to the market with aquatic products and meat, but I think it is okay now after so long.
The government has since banned the sale of wildlife for food, but the reopening of markets has drawn criticism from around the world as the death toll from the pandemic continues to mount. Wet markets are popular venues to buy fresh meat, vegetables, and fish across Asia, most selling common everyday produce to locals. At affordable prices.
We will still go to the wet markets even if it's unsafe because the average prices of the supermarkets are higher.
Workers at Baishizhou Market say they are now required to disinfect their stalls several times a day. Nevertheless, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said this week the decision to reopen wet markets was unfathomable. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
The monks of Pabuk Temple in Lamphun, Thailand, observe Earth Day every morning by collecting alms through methods that minimize waste. They've transformed the village of Pabuk into a model for zero-waste living. VOA's Warankana Chumchun reports.
2 decades ago, the Buddhist monks of Pabuk Temple in Lamphun, Thailand, set a goal for themselves: to cut plastic and food waste to zero. Their significant innovation is this mobile food cabinet. They encourage Pabuk residents to put rice and hot curry in the provided bowls. Doing so eliminates plastic containers as they collect alms.
We have been able to reduce food waste and eliminate the use of 7,000 plastic bags a year.
Pabuk Temple is setting an example in Thailand, a country that produces at least 27 million tons of waste each year, 2 million of it plastic. At first, people resisted. They were used to the convenience of buying cooked or dry food in plastic containers from the market. So the monks had to be strategic.
We delayed the alms collection by an hour to 7 a.m., which is when the villagers finish cooking their breakfast. We asked the entire community to enforce the plastic ban. If someone still used plastic containers, others would just say, hey, we are not using plastic bags anymore.
The Temple Zero Waste Initiative inspired the entire village. In 2006, Pabuk residents began sorting out their trash, years before Zero Waste campaign caught on in the rest of Thailand. Food waste goes to compost. Plastic and glass are recycled. Broken appliances, like this rice cooker or a detergent bag, are turned into something useful, like a planter.
It's good for growing vegetables, very easy to move around.
Today, Pabuk is a zero-waste model community. It has won dozens of national awards and welcomed tens of thousands of visitors who come to learn about zero-waste practices.
Basically, every household takes care of their own trash. We do not need a garbage truck to pick up anything.
Keeping the mission alive takes a village, or rather, a village and a temple.
I think we have an important role because people listen to what we say. Our interest isn't limited to our faith. We also care about the environment.
Pabuk Zero Waste journey is as old as the temple's mobile food cabinet. It may be showing some wear and tear, but the monks said they'll keep using it until it breaks, so that nothing goes to waste. Warang Kanachomchun, VOA News.
These days, sports fans worldwide can do little more than talk about sports, as most stadium events have been canceled due to the coronavirus. In America, that includes discussion of how stadiums are furthering their efforts to go green. VOA's Ira Melman explores how U.S. sports stadiums are changing, welcoming earth-friendly options on this Earth Day.
These new stadiums not only have futuristic appearances, but are planned to contribute to a cleaner Earth by installing solar panels, LED lighting and scoreboards, waste composters, and translucent coating on windows. For M&T Bank Stadium in Baltimore, Maryland, the Stadium Authority's Director of Facilities, Jeff Provenzano, says it's all about saving energy, even by doing things as simple as turning off the lights and appliances.
I had the team come into us because they had a stake in the energy, asking us to reduce the electric bill. It was all fiscal at that time. They give you an idea of how we addressed electricity, and just by addressing low-lying fruit, in the first couple of years, we actually reduced our kilowatts by the millions. You know, refrigerators would run empty all year round, I mean, all off season. Coolers would run empty all season long, and then just turn them off.
Saving energy is not the only reason behind the going green measures at both M&T Bank Stadium and the adjacent baseball stadium, Orioles Park at Camden Yards. Phil Hudson runs capital projects and planning for the Maryland Stadium Authority.
We made a conscious effort to address elements that both had a sustainable benefit and also a financial benefit.
Efforts by the M&T Bank Stadium and Orioles Park have been signified by an international rating agency called LEED, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. One of the world's leading green design, architecture, and engineering companies, HOK, lays claim to a stadium that's been awarded LEED's highest certification, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, Georgia. Chris DeVolder is a managing partner of HOK. He designed the Atlanta Stadium.
It was the largest professional sports facility to achieve LEED Platinum in the entire world. I think that every project that we're able to incorporate sustainability in sports is a great step forward, a great achievement.
The renewable energy produced by its 4,000 solar panels can power 10 Atlanta Falcons football games or 13 Atlanta United soccer matches. Orioles Park in Baltimore, Maryland became the first U.S. sports venue to obtain a LEED rating for an existing building within 6 years after it opened in 1992. Ira Melman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's VOA Asia for today. Thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow.